Today is September 11th, 2014. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing Ron Fisher, professor of economics and former head of the Honors College at Michigan State University. Ron, I'd like to start by having you tell us a little about your childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings and parents.
Well, I'm from upstate New York, born, grew up there, a GE family. Relatives all worked for General Electric. That was a one-time their sort of centrist place and headquarters in upstate New York.
Where exactly? In
Schenectady.
In Schenectady.
But my mother and her family are from Detroit. So I always had these two homes, both upstate New York and Michigan. And so that's a little bit of interesting tidbits.
Right. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have a brother and a sister.
And where do they live?
They both still live in upstate New York.
Oh, they do. Yes. And what was your childhood like? I mean, was it a carefree, wonderful childhood, or was it less so?
Well, I'm old, so I can hardly remember it. It's very difficult to remember back that far. I can't even remember last Tuesday, let alone when I was a child, you know. But I think it was pretty standard for people growing up in the 1950s and 1960s, right? So, you know, my father worked and my mother took care of the family. And I think the only really interesting thing is that I grew up in a house that my grandfather had built.
That's impressive.
By building, I mean building himself. It was a Sears kit house, but a very large Sears kit house with several floors. And my grandfather had built that house, and so we lived in it. And when I was there, my grandparents were still there. And my father completely renovated the house. So its first life was the house that my grandfather built, and its second life was the house that my father renovated and the one that we lived in growing up.
Does the family still live in that house?
Interestingly, yes. My brother now owns that house. And he and his wife had it completely renovated. Not like my father, who did the work himself, but they had professionals come in and completely renovate the house. So now it's in its third chapter.
That's great. That's a great story. Now you tell us about your college education.
My college education was at Michigan State, of course.
Now, why you say of course? Why of course?
Well, because I'm here now, right? And so many people know about that.
But what led you to Michigan
State?
Well,
there's the real story and the story I always tell people. So the real story is that I wanted to go away from home, that at the time— in the East, and still today, I think, in the East, the public university system not quite as developed as it is here in the Midwest. And the really good universities in the East are the private universities. But they're very expensive. And frankly, I couldn't afford going to one of those places. And even if I could afford it with scholarships, I didn't feel that I would be comfortable in the environment necessarily. You know, the public universities in New York, the State University of New York system wasn't great at the time. I wanted to go away. I needed to go a place that I could afford. And Michigan had always been a second home because we were here two or three times every year visiting my grandparents and my mother's family. So I naturally looked into the opportunities here in Michigan. And so that's how I ended up at Michigan State.
And Michigan State was lucky, I think.
I don't know about that.
And you were lucky, too.
Well, when it actually came down to it, I had a chance to go to Dartmouth, but I really didn't feel comfortable in that environment. Rutgers offered me a fancy scholarship. Rutgers actually offered me the equivalent of what the MSU Alumni Distinguished Scholarship is. But I went to Rutgers, and having you coming from New York know the environment, you know, to some extent, New Brunswick, New Jersey, and having grown up in sort of a small suburban upstate town, I just didn't feel that that big city environment was really for me, and I fit much better at Michigan State.
Now, what was it that led you to choose economics as a major?
Accident.
Oh, let's hear about that accident.
Because, I wasn't an economics major. In college, I was a chemistry major.
I did not know that.
My undergraduate degree is in chemistry.
Oh, really?
So I came to MSU as a science guy and studied chemistry. And remember, I had grown up in a GE family.
Right.
So sort of the business. And so my original idea was that I would go to college, get an undergraduate degree in chemistry, then get an MBA and work in the chemical industry. But at some point in college, the idea of having a business job in the chemical industry lost its appeal to me. And I had taken some economics classes because I thought I was going to business school. And it seemed sort of interesting. So I said, well, why don't I give that a try?
Oh, fascinating. I had forgotten that you were not an economics undergraduate major.
No, but then I was fortunate enough that I'd done enough of the science early enough that I still had time when I was a senior to do a lot of economics classes before I went to graduate school.
Oh, good.
Including Economics 444.
Oh, which I happen to know of. Right. Now, was joining the faculty at Michigan State your first job out of graduate school?
Well, not really. When I went to graduate school, I went to graduate school at Brown. The universities weren't quite as generous with graduate students as they are these days. So they funded us for 3 years, but then we had to sort of find our own funding after that point. I was teaching at Brown at the time, and so that was a way to get funded. And I probably could have stayed and done that, but I was fortunate to have an opportunity to get a position, a research internship position with an organization in Washington. So I spent a year in Washington working with an organization called the U.S. Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, an organization that no longer exists, was because of political and budgetary reasons, was eventually killed. But it was a really interesting operation, and for what the kind of work that I was doing in economics involving intergovernmental fiscal relations, it was a perfect placement professionally, and I made a lot of great contacts in that year in Washington that I still people I'm still in contact with professionally and personally these days. So I went from Brown to D.C. and then from D.C. to Michigan State.
And let me ask you, I'm just curious, did you notice a difference in atmosphere and ambiance between Brown and Michigan State?
Well, yes. I mean, yes, there's a big difference between Brown and Michigan State and sort of there's a difference in the people who are there, obviously. It's a different set of folks. But I think more than that, it's East Coast versus Midwest.
And what do you see as the...
Well, I mean, it changes over time. And, you know, when I was at Brown, it was a long time ago. But, you know, Providence was a very... had been an old industrial city in the East, was in decline at the time. Now it's a hip and with it place again, but it was in decline at the time. It was very ethnic, a large Italian community, a very large Portuguese community. In fact, on the east side of Providence, where the university is located, was the Portuguese neighborhood. back from its fishing heritage and a large African American population. So you had quite an interesting mix of that, very different than you would find here in East Lansing or in the Lansing area.
At that time.
At that time. But even I think, you know, today it's a little different because of the university today. But certainly at that time, we didn't have that kind of mix of folks. So you had a different community in which you had this special university that also had different people,
right.
In it.
You are still teaching, of course, and I understand that you and Carl Lee.
What is this, still? Still? I'm not that old. Still?
You opened this interview saying you were too old to remember, and now you're saying I'm not that old. Well, I'll let you have it both ways. You are still teaching, and I understand that you and Carl Leadholm have put together a special course on economics and sports. Can you tell us a little more about that course?
Well, it's an integrative studies class, which is sort of an unusual animal here at Michigan State. These classes, these general education classes that students take with essentially no prerequisites and theoretically use various perspectives to examine an issue, not just a single disciplinary perspective. And so Leadholm and I had always been interested in sports and sort of followed the economics of it a little bit. And it's not the professional specialty of either one of us. So we decided after I left as dean of the Honors College that we'd create this thing. It would be interesting for both of us to do, sort of to entertain ourselves. And so it's a class that covers economic, financial, accounting, legal, historical perspectives about the business side of sports, about sports as an industry. And we look at both professional sports in the United States and collegiate sports. But the real focus is thinking of it as an industry and how you would analyze this industry. Which is, of course, a lot of people don't think of it as a business, but part of the message that we try to convey to the students that it is.
I think fewer and fewer people are not regarding it as an industry.
Right.
What other courses in economics do you teach?
Well, I've taught a lot of things over the years. These days, I'm teaching, in addition to that, I teach introductory economics, principles of economics. And I teach a public policy class focused on state and local government finance, which is my professional specialty.
Do you notice any difference in the student body from when you started teaching here and now?
You know, I suppose there is, but to me, the student body is just a reflection of society, and society is different now than it was 40 years ago. In all the things we see, and so we're different than we were 40 years ago. And so I think all the things that have changed in society, students are just a product of that. And so obviously they use technology now, and they didn't when I started. And the technology has a lot of implications for how we all operate. But I don't think it's students per se that are different in that sense. I just think it's society is different. And so they're a product of this different society. And so it's not surprising.
So you don't see any major difference in the students aside from their reflection coming from this society.
Well, sure, they're different in lots of ways, but I think it's just a product of the fact that society is different these days.
Yeah.
Communication is very different. People receive a lot more information than they did, 40 years ago.
So they're better informed today?
Well, about some things. I think, information flows much more quickly, much more freely. So they're better informed in some ways. You have different skills now than you had, 40 years ago. Different skills are valued than they were 40 years ago. So are students different? Yes. But everybody in society is different than they were 40 years ago as well.
Are there any high and or low points or merely amusing incidents in your teaching career that you would like to share with us? And I'd like to start with the low points first and then move up the ladder.
Oh, I don't think I can think of any individual things. I mean,
really?
Well, there's zillions, you know. I mean, it's the same, you know, you and everyone you know who's been in this business, you know, has the same kind of experiences. You have individual cases that are difficult, but they tend to be relatively small matters in the big scheme of things.
Like,
individual student cases that become difficult.
Can you pick out
No,
one?
I don't think I can really remember any specific thing, you know. But from the point of view, from your teaching point of view, of course, the really interesting highs are impact that you have on students. And so sometimes it's impact that you know about and you keep in contact with those students and you always interact with them. Other times it's surprise impacts where you discover someone who remembers their time in your class and you had no idea that you were having some kind of an impact. It's those kinds of, I think, connections with students over a long period of time, some of which are well-known, some of which are surprising, that are sort of the highs of the business, right? I mean, you can have an individual experience in a given class, but that goes away quickly. But, you know, if you run into someone who was in your class 30 years ago and remembers who you were and that was a positive experience, that's really the kind of high that you remember. So I'll tell you one funny story. This is specific to economics, so I don't know how well it will translate. But in economics, of course, we use a lot of pictures, graphs, okay, what we call graphs, lots of pictures, supply and demand graphs of all different types. And so one year I was reading the course evaluations for my courses. In the old days, I used to do that. And so the student really hated my class, thought I was one of the worst instructors ever. And he wrote that he particularly didn't like the class because I used so many grafts, G-R-A-F-T-S. So that sort of led me to discount that student's criticism.
I love it. I love it. Do you have any other incidents like that? No, but that's one to treasure. What research activities were you involved in?
Well, my research specialty is the fiscal environment, fiscal policy, fiscal behavior of subnational governments, state and local governments. So, and the interaction between them, between state and local governments, and the interaction between that sector and the national government. So that's the kind of research that I've done over the years. I've been fortunate that I've been able to be involved in some external entities connected to that. So I started out working for this intergovernmental commission in D.C. That was very interesting because the commission members were appointed by the president but represented all three levels of government. So there were federal government, cabinet members, governors, and local government officials from around who were part of the commission. And then the commission had a professional staff, and I was part of that professional staff doing research on issues that affected all three levels of government and their interconnections. And then I had an opportunity in Michigan when I went on leave from MSU and I was appointed the deputy director of the State Treasury Department. And so I worked in state government for a few years, practitioner kinds of things. I had an opportunity to spend some time at the Australian National University, where they too had a research institute studying what we call fiscal federalism, the interaction between levels of government in the Australian system, which was really interesting. I've had some opportunity to do some work in China, where decentralization is a big issue in China right now. So the decentralization of government services and revenues. So having been involved a little bit in trying to work on those kinds of problems in the Chinese context, and now I'm currently working with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank on these same kind of issues for the New England states. And I've had other kinds of opportunities like that. So it's been an opportunity where I'm doing academic research on the issues, but also trying to get sort of practitioner experience or involvement with this kind of public policy work.
Do you find that there's a difference when you do the work as academic research and do the work as part of governmental research?
Well, sure. I mean,
what are the
when you're inside government, it's not so much a research job as it's an operational job. So you have day-to-day issues and things have to happen very quickly. You're not doing a three-year detailed research project that you might be doing as an academic. But you try to translate the work. I mean, I think for people who do public policy work, as I do, the big problem is translating the public policy research that's going on in academic environments or in other research environments and translating that into public policy implementation or public policy action. But that's very difficult. There's a long lag, when you're involved and when you have these opportunities to get involved, then you can try to bring some of the research results into practical implication, but small impact.
What do you think is the cause of the small impact or the...
Oh, it's inertia. I mean, it takes a long time for new ideas to be accepted anywhere. It's difficult to make changes in government, you know, and sometimes big changes. Sometimes people don't grasp the research or understand it or believe it. So it's very difficult to get people to change long-held beliefs, and sometimes that's what's going on when, an entirely different policy can happen. So most times in the public policy world that I deal with, government finance, things happen slowly. But over time, you can get, some dramatic change, but it usually takes a lot of time for that to happen, learning.
Have you noticed a dramatic change in public policy in the state of Michigan towards funding the public universities?
Well, we know the data. The data that public university funding has not kept up with overall government spending or with the university spending. That's not true just in Michigan, but it's true nationally. So public universities aren't funded the way they once were. I think at some point a political decision or a public policy decision was made. I don't think it was necessarily an instantaneous decision, but over time, essentially the decision was made that the benefits of public universities are largely private, that the public benefits of public education are not as great, maybe, as people once thought. The benefits are largely going to the students, so the students should pay for it. And, that perception led to, a complete change in how universities are funded. But the nature of the public universities changed also over that time. And many of them became much more research intensive, broadened their research focus from what it maybe was originally. So the combination of the universities changing their character and the political environment deciding that the benefits are largely private and students should pay for it has sort of led to this national change in how universities are funded. It's not just here. The days when public higher education was free in California are long gone. This is something now that people think, for better or worse, that students benefit, they should pay.
I see. That's very interesting to me, because when I went to college, it was absolutely free.
Correct.
But I went to a city college.
City college is no longer free. The public California public university system that was free for a long time no longer is. And even after they started having tuition in the four-year universities in California, the community colleges continued to be free for many years but are no longer. They actually now have pretty substantial tuition. So all over, there's just been this idea that you know, it's a private benefit and you really should pay for it. And it is true that the gain, the economic gain to having a college education has gotten larger and larger and continues to grow these days. So the economic benefit of a college degree in the modern economy, in the modern market, is really high. And so even though cost to students is higher than it was 30 or 40 years ago, it's still worth it to the students because of the huge advantage that it gives them in the modern market economy.
In the economic sense.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But in other senses, too. I mean, because it's not, you know, not only are college-educated folks doing better economically, they're less likely to be unemployed, they have a lot higher incomes, but their behavior is very different in many other ways as well. And so
from a social point
of
view.
That's right.
So there are benefits beyond the economic.
Well, they're changes.
And they're
changes. I don't know whether they're benefits, but they're certainly changes in behavior.
Well, so when you think in terms of community benefits, or maybe the opposite,
right,
there is an impact on the greater community by the college education.
Right.
So maybe the state should be interested in that. I don't know. I want to. I know that you were, in addition to teaching and doing research, you were also chairman of the department for how many years?
4 years.
4 years. And what did that involve that was different than just teaching? And I hesitate to say just teaching.
Well, you know, department chairs, what they do is pretty standard. I mean, they're sort of responsible for maintaining the faculty and graduate students of the department. So you have to recruit new faculty members or replace faculty members. You have to maintain the graduate program. You have to set up the teaching schedule. It's the operational side of an academic department. It's not different in economics, I don't think, than it is in any other department. You just keep things going. The only difference is that the economics department of Michigan State has always traditionally and continues today not had one person be chairman for a long period of time, but rather different faculty members would take on the role of doing that for a couple of years and then pass it on to another member of the department. So we've always had a faculty member who will serve as chair for 3 or 4 years and then give it on to someone else in the department. And it's just maintaining the administrative continuation of the day-to-day operations of the place, really.
Now, you went on in the academic hierarchy to become a dean of the Honors College, and we would be interested in learning more about the Honors College, what its goals are, how it functions, and what its role in the university is. That's all. Now you can take off.
Well, I don't know if I remember all of that stuff now that I'm not doing that for quite a while. The Honors College, look, started back in 1955 or 1956, it was a couple of people on the faculty at the time had this idea that Michigan State, as it was growing and changing in character, would be attracting some high-ability students, and that maybe a different academic program would be appropriate for those students. And President Hanna, I think, understood that academic argument and also saw that the Honors College could be a way of helping to grow Michigan State in size and in reputation. So these couple of faculty members and President Hanna sort of embraced this idea and it started to grow. And the one decision that was made, which turned out to be quite fateful, was that rather than creating a separate academic program for these high-ability students, they decided that the high-ability students would have the opportunity to craft their own academic programs. So when universities create honors programs or honors colleges, they usually follow one of two models. The typical model is you have a standard set of academic expectations for regular students, and you have a different set of academic expectations or an academic path or a set of requirements for the honor students, two parallel different academic programs. But the other model, which Michigan State really pioneered is this idea that you don't create a fixed, standard, separate academic path for the honors students, but rather you let them develop something that's tied to their own plans and their own ability levels. So this crafting of their own curriculum turned out to be a really dramatic decision on the part of those few people who were organizing the Honors College initially. And Michigan State went off on that path, and it allowed us to attract, I think, some really talented students over the years who appreciated the idea that they'd have more responsibility for making their own academic decisions and not have to follow a standard path that someone else had set for them. And so that attracted a particular type of student to Michigan State. It gave Michigan State's Honors College a character that was different from other places. It allowed it to really flourish and grow in the 1960s and early 1970s. And only a few other places have copied that model, even today, I think being different in how we do honors education and being able to say that students are going to have more academic flexibility and more responsibility for their own path has really been a comparative advantage for Michigan State in attracting high-achieving students from all over the country.
Good. How would you evaluate your experience as dean of that college? By the way, how long were you dean?
I did that for 11 years.
That's a long time.
The Honors College had declined some in the 1980s in size and I think in reputation on campus, not because of anything the Honors College inside did, but because of some decisions that the university administration made that had the effect, maybe unintended effect, of sort of decreasing its success and size and viability.
What were some of those?
Probably not worth getting into. In the early or mid-1990s, President McPherson, who was relatively new to the university and who was a fan of the Honors College, and then Provost Simon, Luana Simon, who was provost then, both thought that reinvigorating the Honors College, for whatever reasons it had declined, was something to think about. And so Provost Simon appointed a review committee to look into the Honors College. As a former Honors College member, I was lucky enough to be on that committee. And so we all had some ideas for things that should happen. And so my interest in doing that was really as a way to try to make an institution that had been really important to me when I was a student at Michigan State equally valuable to current students, because it had sort of had lost some of some of those opportunities have been lost. So that's why I was interested in maybe trying to be part of that. And it only happened because, I mean, an individual dean can't make those things happen. It only happened because the president, Peter McPherson, and the provost, Luana Simon, really wanted those things to happen. And so we were able to bring about some changes in the university and a refocus to the Honors College that led to its growing in size, a re-emphasis on the academic flexibility component that had been part of its original charter, and more success in attracting really high-achieving students from all across the country again. Has sort of returned the university to its historical success in some of the national and international fellowship competitions. So all of those kinds of things were not a product of what I did. They were a product of a university decision, a conscious university decision supported by not only the sort of intellectual support of the president and the provost, but the financial support of the university and the administrative direction that really allow the Honors College to return to its glory days of the 60s and 70s.
And is it still there?
As far as I know, it's still there. I think it's still going strong. I just read a news report that this year they had the largest Honors College freshman class ever. So I think things are still going well. Some of the people I worked with are still there. So many of them have changed. Much of the staff has changed. People have retired and moved on to other things. But, I think it's still doing well.
Good. How would you evaluate the state of higher education in America today?
I don't think I can. I mean,
You have no thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert on this. I mean, what I see as a sort of just someone who looks at it is that it's still sort of the gold standard of higher education in the world. And we know that because people from all over the world continue to come here to buy our services. As an economist, sometimes people don't think of higher education as being an export industry.
But it is
an export industry to the extent that people from all around the world, are interested in getting educated here. So I've many times had conversations with political people in Michigan, and I say to them that when a student from another country comes to Michigan, to the University of Michigan or to Michigan State, that's the same thing as when General Motors sells a Buick in that other country. And it's very hard sometimes for political people to understand that. But in both cases, resources from the other country are coming to Michigan, buying something that we're producing here. So it's still the gold standard around the world for higher education. It continues to expand. So, we still have, we're different than almost any other country in the proportion of students who go on to get higher education degrees. It's not, most other countries don't have that kind of number of people going on to that. So it's still, I think, the model. A lot of other countries are now trying to copy it. Developing countries who are now trying to develop higher education systems similar. Obviously there are problems and issues of all different types in that business, as it is a business, but it still seems to be pretty well regarded.
And do you think that American higher education, therefore, is more dependent somewhat on funding from these foreign students coming here?
Well, we're dependent on anybody who buys our service, you know, whether it's American students or foreign students, you know. So obviously you need customers, and so you need clients. And so but I think it's always been that way. You know, now that you have less public support for public higher education, that becomes a little more of a focus, right? But private universities have always had to focus on their sources of funding.
Right. What would your advice be to anyone wanting to go into the world of academia or into the world of public service?
I don't know that I have any advice. I guess be sure that's what you want to do.
Is that what you would tell your children?
Yeah, I mean, I think they should do what they want to do, and so you really want to try to find that activity, an activity that you enjoy and have some capability with. Be sure that's what you want to do. I mean, I think that's the first thing you say. I mean, you know, when I talk to students and they come to see me about what am I going to do or how should I be preparing after college, and I always say to them, well, what is it you want to do? And I say, well, maybe they'll say, maybe I want to get this degree. And I said, well, with that degree, you will be expected to do research. Is that what you want to do? Or they'll say, well, I get this degree. I say, well, with that degree, you would be expected to run a government agency. Is that what you want to do? So I think you really need to decide what it is you want to do and then follow the path that gets you to that point. Because, I mean, not everyone has the luxury of being able to make those kind of decisions, right? To decide what you want to do as opposed to what you have to do. But if you are fortunate enough to be in a position to have that luxury, then you'd like to say, sit back and think about what it is you'd like, you know, what is it you like to do. And obviously you have to have the capability for it. You know, I may like to play basketball, but the probability that I'm going to be able to dunk a basketball is near zero. And so I don't have that capability. So you have to find both things. And so I think that's the advice you'd give people. If you want to be in academia, you better want to do research, because that's what the business is about. If you don't enjoy studying things, I always say to students, do you want to study things or do you want to do things? If you want to be in academia, you want to study things, because that's really what we do. If you really want to do things, manage things, you're better off in a different environment where your day-to-day job is to run something as opposed to, and that could be in business, it could be in government, it could be in the non-governmental sector, in the NGOs where your day-to-day job is to do something as opposed to sort of study things, which is what academics do.
Right, and they also teach.
Yeah, but that's studying stuff too,
yes.
Right? I mean, you study stuff to learn about it, so then you can communicate it to people, you study how to do those kinds of things. But so the focus is not on getting the bus system to operate today, so that Route 20 can actually work, right? The driver shows up on time, the bus is functionally capable of making the route, the weather is okay, there are no accidents. That's your day-to-day job if you're running the transportation system. That's not what an academic does.
I know you're far from retirement, but have you given any thought as to what you would like to do after retirement?
No.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
I don't know. What are you interested in?
I'm interested in everything.
Yeah, I know, but that's not, it's too broad. I mean, tell me what kinds of things you might be interested in knowing
about. For instance, after retirement, would you want to continue your research?
Oh, I don't know. What I do is very public policy oriented, so you can envision still writing a blog after retirement about some public policy thing. I mean, I know there are some people who do that. I know people who've retired from the academic business who still go to some of the professional conferences because they like to stay involved, okay? So you may do those kinds of things, whether you'll be writing journal articles or not, and wrestling with editors and referees, probably that's not probably as much fun anymore, right? So, well, I don't know.
For instance, consulting?
Well, I do a little bit of consulting. I don't do a lot. Most of it is public sector related, and so again, if there was a particular issue or something that came up, you might work on that. The problem with being an academic consultant in the public arena is usually they don't like your advice. So you come and tell them about what the research shows, this, that, and the other thing, and they say, yeah, but. That can be fun, but it can be frustrating as well. So to be really honest, Pauline, I haven't thought a lot about it. I'm just trying to get through this semester. I've got my classes. I've got to get those functioning. I'm trying to get two papers published. I'm trying to get the new edition of my textbook out. So I've got so many things going right now that Michigan State, in its ultimate wisdom, changed the course management system, the electronic course management system that we use, switching over from a company called Angel to a new company called Desire to Learn. This transition has been tremendously difficult for old people like me. We've been struggling with the new technology of how to just a new system. So I'm just trying to get through this week, this semester, see if I can make all, I got all these things on my plate, make them work. And then, you know, the long run, I haven't even had a chance to think about it.
So in the long run, it sounds to me, is if you want a continuation of your present life.
I don't know long run, but the short run, the next couple of years, that's what I'm going to do. I've got a couple of things on the docket for this year. Liedholm and I were just talking the other day about whether we'll teach the sports economics class one more time next year. We'll probably do that. As I say, I've got this project going on with the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. That's going to keep me busy for the next year or so. So, you know, in the short run, there's things going on. What's going to happen long term, I don't know. You never know what new opportunity is going to come along, you know. I've never had a career that I've planned out every step. Instead, things sort of, it's like the Honors College job, for example. I never set out to say, oh, I'm going to be a dean. Now, I wasn't someone who said, I'll be a department chair, then I'll be a dean, then I'll be a provost. I didn't follow that path. It was just something that came along with an opportunity. I was interested, so I did it. I've sort of followed that kind of sort of unplanned path rather than a program thing. And so I'm still in that mode.
So in conclusion, is there anything else I'll ask you again that you would like to talk about?
I don't know what I can think about. What is it you want me to tell you? I mean, you know,
nothing.
Well, I don't know what you're looking for.
I'm just giving you the opportunity.
There's nothing particular. I mean, I've been fortunate because I've enjoyed being an academic. I really enjoyed what I do, and most people in their careers maybe don't always enjoy what they do, right? And so. My father worked for General Electric for 38 years, and some of those years he really enjoyed what he was doing and enjoyed the people he was working with, but for many of those years he did not. It was a job, right, that you had to do, and you didn't always necessarily enjoy the General Electric bureaucracy or the new bosses they sent in who were on the career track and were going to put this operation in ship shape, you know. So he didn't always enjoy what was for him a job. He was proud of working for General Electric. I always say that we had no Whirlpool or RCA appliances in our household, right? it was not always something that he enjoyed. But every morning, 7:30, off he'd go. He didn't take sick days. I mean, 38 years, right to work every day because it was his responsibility. And so you get that sense of responsibility. And I think we all learn that from other people, in my case, watching my father. But I've been fortunate to have something that I enjoy as a career. It's not just a job. And so Michigan State has been wonderful to me. I'm still involved and in contact with Brown as well. I still enjoy my contact with Brown. It is a different environment completely, but I'm still, to have both of those academic connections is really, really nice. And so the academic life has been great for me, so I have no complaints. The university has been wonderful. I've been really fortunate to have, a career where I didn't have to think of it as a job, right? Not everybody is that fortunate.
Do you have any hobbies, by the way?
Hobbies? Over the years, I've done different things. I've always, for a long time, played golf on and off. When I was younger, I tried to be really good at it, and it was tremendously frustrating. And now I just do it for fun. I've always been involved in sports, and so I spent many years as a sports coach and referee. And so, that was when my children were younger, maybe 20 years, I was a hockey coach and a hockey referee. And so that was something that kept me going. And I'm still involved in that a little bit, not to the degree I was then. I've always enjoy outdoor stuff, right? So I go hiking and camping and that kind of stuff, when I can. So, you know, I don't know if you call those hobbies or just sort of things you do during your life.
So it sounds to me as if your life has been very fulfilling.
Busy, 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 continuing to be busy.
Fulfilling and happily busy.
Doing well, doing well.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your willingness to come and talk with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, although I can't imagine that anyone will find this very interesting or want to listen to it.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Thank you.
Sure.